The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Liz Elliott from the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, July 2019, Volume 20, Number 7. This is the second of three installments of the July issue. On the front cover this month, we have a very relaxed Oprah holding a tray of four drinks. She's wearing khaki pants and a yellow cable knit sweater. Her hair is down and curly, and she's got on gold dangle earrings with dark tortoiseshell sunglasses. And she's got a soft smile on her face, and she's looking off of a porch out into the distance. She's got a silver tray in her hands with a white towel on the top, and on the tray are four yellow drinks. They're set in martini glasses with sprigs of lemongrass hanging out the top, and she is on a beautiful porch in a very tropical green setting. There are white rocking chairs on the porch, and the floor of the porch is dark teak wood, and up in the top left-hand corner of the cover, there is a lemongrass green rectangle. And inside the rectangle, there is the Oprah O, done in white, almost a perfect circle with an oval opening in the center. And as we open the cover this month, our first stop is the world according to Gail, where Oprah's friend, Gail King, gives us advice on what to eat and watch, listen to, and read. And the first piece of advice she has for us is what to eat. She says, "One thing I love about travel is discovering great new restaurants. A family weekend in Cape May, New Jersey led us to the Ebbitt Room. The waiter vowed I'd never tasted anything like the ricotta donuts with orange caramel sauce. He was right. They were crunchy on the outside and chewy on the inside with the perfect amount of sweet. Hello, Clean Plate Club." And there's a picture of the donuts on a perfectly round white plate, and they look very much like the beignet of New Orleans. They are rounded donuts, kind of fried looking, golden brown, and there is some powdered sugar sprinkled across the top. Next, Gail suggests that we tune in, and it reads, "Knock, knock. Who's there?" "Kenan Thompson, an SNL cast member for 16 seasons and counting. Jeff Foxworthy, whose redneck routines make us belly laugh. And Chrissy Teigen. I know you've said her cheeky tweets to your friends." NBC is getting the trio together to judge the new reality competition, Bring the Funny, starting July 9th. The series, hosted by stand-up Amanda Seales, is looking for the next great comedian, and the winner takes home $250,000. Let the LOLs begin. Next, we see a picture of Gail King with Jennifer Lopez, and she advises us, "What advice can I share with Jennifer Lopez before she turns the big 5-0 on July 24th? Life only gets better." But the superstar already knows that because she's got twins who adore her, a thriving career, and a big ring from her fiancé, Alex Rodriguez. "When I celebrated 50, Oprah threw me a bash in New York City. When you're J-Lo, you go on a 25-city summer tour appropriately titled, It's My Party. Join me in the front row to sing Happy Birthday when Jennifer's concert swings through the Big Apple." Next, we see a picture of a giant lion on a rock, and it reads, "I've seen the Lion King musical 9 times since its Broadway debut in 1997. So when I learned Disney was remaking the 1994 film with Beyoncé as our new Nala and Donald Glover as Simba, I almost burst into a circle of life. On July 19th, cue Hakuna Matata sing-alongs in movie theaters across the country." Next, we see a picture of Ruth Reichel's new book entitled Save Me the Plums. And it says, A little quote from the book: pay attention to the ordinary things. It's the key to an extraordinary life. And Gail says, acclaimed food critic and former gourmet editor Ruth Reichel gets it right in her memoir, Save Me the Plums. Most people think an exceptional existence is filled with game-changing events. But true fulfillment comes from appreciating day-to-day interactions and conversations. May we all remember not to take the small things for granted. And now we move on to the Live Your Best Life section. And we'll start with the interview that's always entitled My Best Life. And this month, it's with MJ Rodriguez. And about 3/4 of the page is taken up with a picture of MJ Rodriguez. And her hair is pulled back, and she has this bright green eyeshadow and a crop top that's composed almost entirely of beautiful soft pink and orange marabou feathers. And she has on, I'm not sure if it's a skirt or pants, but pink bottoms to match, and matching pink long nails. And moving to the left side of the page, we see a column with the Best Life interview, and it begins with why we love her. For her tender performance in FX's Pose as Blanca Rodriguez, a trans drag ball star who becomes a house mother to LGBTQ youth. What she's up to? Slaying the competition with her House of Evangelista in Pose's second season, which started June 11th. What she can't live without? Her Dolce and Gabbana clutch. She says, I walked into a store one day and said I wouldn't touch or buy anything. Then I saw this black leather bag with a gold chain. Lo and behold, it was the only one left. A guy working there told me it wasn't in season, so I might not see it again. It was a splurge, but I got my money's worth. It's Dolce and Gabbana, honey. Next, she says she can't live without her mom. She says, she's always been a big support system for me, ensuring that I'm okay and making the right decisions. I remember her getting blisters on her feet walking me to auditions, which I've been doing since I was 11. She's very hands-on, telling me what I need to do, how to do it, and how to keep my head up while remaining classy. If it weren't for my mom, I'd be acting a fool. She also can't live without Tom and Jerry. I still watch that show faithfully because I'm a big old kid. Those two are ridiculous. I crack up every time Tom's foot gets pounded on or Jerry pulls his tail off. If I could turn on Cartoon Network and it's playing, I'd be laughing all night. She also cannot live without gratitude. I was young and green when I did a guest appearance on Nurse Jackie. I played a trans character named Lana, and at the time I hadn't told anyone I was trans. I wasn't ready to let the world know because I thought I'd be ostracized. But people on the set saw me before I saw myself and really looked after me. I remember that experience now and think, oh baby, look how far she's come. She's blossomed. MJ Rodriguez also says she cannot live without tuna tartare. She says, when I first tried it, I thought, I can eat this and nothing else. I don't remember the restaurant where I had it or what kind of concoction the chef put together, but it tasted like all sorts of flavors I deserve in my mouth. Moving on to the next page of the Live Your Best Life section. The entire page has a title that says, Act Up, with a picture of a suffragette standing under an umbrella and a sandwich board sign that reads, Women, Use Your Vote. And the caption beneath it reads, The 19th Amendment, which Congress passed in 1919, clearing the way for states' ratification, granted American women the right to vote. But a century later, we've yet to achieve full gender equality. Here are 5 problem areas you can help fix. The first of the 5 sections has a picture of Serena Williams in action, and it reads, Waiting Game. Grand Slam tennis tournaments offer equal prize money to male and female competitors, But that's where parody stops. And unless you've achieved icon status like Serena Williams, the highest earning female athlete, the gap pay in sports is stadium size. Beyond events like Wimbledon, 71% of tennis's top 100 men out-earn women of the same ranking. So publicly root for ladies who serve, dribble, and pitch, and buy tickets to their matches and games even if you can't attend to boost sales and, hopefully, paychecks. The next section is entitled Office Building, and it reads, the surge of women elected to Congress last year, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, was invigorating, even intoxicating. Do the math, though, and the stats are sobering. Just 44 women have been governor in all of U.S. history. Today, only 21% of mayors of cities of 30,000 plus are female. Yet, we have the power at the polls. More women than men have voted in every quadrennial election since 1964. Volunteer with a nonprofit that supports female candidates, like She Should Run, or maybe run yourself. The fourth section is titled Nickeled and Dimed. Makers of personal care products like conditioner, deodorant, and razors routinely charge more when selling to women. As for menstrual necessities, are you sitting down? They're subject to sales tax in 35 states because they qualify as luxury goods, whereas in some states, dandruff shampoo and chapstick do not. If your tampons and pads cost extra, call your legislator and repeat after us, no taxation on menstruation. And the final section is entitled Pedal Pushers. U.S. cities are lousy with statues of men riding horses and waving flags. Tributes to female icons? Not so much. Less than 10% of the country's outdoor sculptures of real-life figures are women, according to the Smithsonian American Art Museum's Art Inventories catalog. But change is taking place from sea to shining sea. New York City gets a statue of Shirley Chisholm this year, and one of Susan DeAnthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton next. San Francisco requires at least 30% of its public artworks depicting historical figures to be ladies. Look for monuments honoring women in your town. If you don't see something, say something to a council member or a congressperson. Now we're going to move to our feature articles section and begin with an article entitled Hungry for Connection. And the opening page shows a big white tray on top of some grass. And on the tray, there is a smaller plate with two types of dip. One looks like a hummus with pomegranate seeds, and the other looks to be maybe a yogurt dip with a little pepper and bright green olive oil drizzled over the top, and some veggies laid out on the small plate. And on the big, clear, white part of the platter, there's a little caption that reads, "Nothing bonds people like a great meal, and sharing one in the fresh air and sunshine brings something extra special to the table." To inspire your own gatherings, we're serving up 5 stories of food and fellowship, plus plenty of recipes and tips to ensure your alfresco feasts are full of flavor. The first of the 5 sections is entitled Taking It to the Streets. Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood has undergone big changes since the 70s. The area was mostly black, but we've had an influx of different races and young people, says Alma Robinson, a retiree who moved to Bed-Stuy in 1983. But one thing has remained constant, the summer block parties. Felicia Kinski, 48, who's lived in the neighborhood all her life and happens to be O's advertising services director, cherishes the camaraderie the celebrations brought to her childhood. We'd hang pennant banners over the block. I'd run up to the 3rd floor of our house, where the tenant would tie the banner to the radiator and drop it out the window. Then I'd run across the street with the other end, she says. Everybody pitched in. Even the corner store would donate soda and flavored ices. Near the bodegas, ramen joints and vegan cafes are popping up, a result of the area's growth. We have people from France, the Dominican Republic, Germany, says Nancy Fahn, a handbag designer who moved to the block with her husband in 2011. While the evolution has created a rich culture, the changes have been challenging for some longtime residents. They require you to adjust your outlook, Robinson says. But we've grown accustomed to the new environment, and the parties have certainly brought us together. With help from fellow Block Association members, Kinski now plans the blowouts, which have featured entertainment spanning from wrestling matches to henna tattoo artists. But the real crowd pleaser is the homemade spreads. Each house has their own little party, and everyone is welcome to stop by and join in, says Kinski, whose menu isn't complete without the sweet and sticky rib she and her husband have perfected over the years. Some folks pass around delicacies like flaky Italian pastries or grilled octopus. One resident carries a tray of buttery empanadas up and down the street. And this free flow of goodies has resulted in lasting connections. A neighbor got to chatting with my dad at the block party one year. Next thing we knew, she was bringing us food, says Fawn. We became friendly after that, and I've brought her cookies around the holidays. After all the feasting and festivities, local jazz musicians help the day end on a high note. As the sun sets, residents congregate in camp chairs with wine and sangria to unwind from the excitement to the sounds of big band and R&B tunes. Though everyone's pleasantly stuffed, they're always hungry for more, says Kinski. In January, I started getting emails saying, we're planning our summer vacation. When's the block party? We don't want to miss it. And with this story, we have a recipe for Felicia's barbecue ribs. This recipe makes two slabs, and the total time to prepare them should be around 7 hours. The ingredients are a half cup of brown sugar, 2 tablespoons kosher salt, 1 tablespoon ground black pepper, 1 tablespoon smoked paprika, 1 tablespoon onion powder, 1 tablespoon garlic powder, 1 tablespoon chili powder, 1 tablespoon cumin, 1 tablespoon dry mustard, 1/4 teaspoon cayenne pepper, and 2 slabs, about 2 pounds each, baby back ribs, membranes removed from back. Step 1. In a small bowl, mix together dry ingredients, removing any clumps. Reserve at least 2 tablespoons if making your own sauce. We have another recipe following for that. Then rub remainder generously on ribs. Let ribs sit uncovered for up to an hour, or covered with plastic wrap in the refrigerator for up to 12 hours. Remove from fridge at least an hour before cooking. Step 2. Prepare charcoal with a chimney starter. Don't use lighter fluid. It can flavor your food. Arrange grill with charcoal and wood chips, hickory, maple, or cherry, under grate on each side. Grill temperature should reach 275. Step 3. On indirect heat in center of grill, cook ribs 3 to 4 hours. When ribs are tender, a toothpick inserted into the meat should slide out with little resistance, and the internal temperature should be at least 185 degrees. Remove from grill and set aside for an hour while you make the sauce. Now following is a recipe for homemade barbecue sauce. The ingredients are 1 28-ounce can of crushed tomatoes, 2 tablespoons honey, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, 2 tablespoons molasses, Worcestershire sauce, 2 tablespoons reserved dry rub, 6 garlic cloves, 1 large onion, 1 tablespoon olive oil. The first step, in a food processor, puree crushed tomatoes until smooth. Strain into a bowl. Add honey, vinegar, molasses, a couple dashes of Worcestershire sauce, and reserved dry rub. The second step. In a food processor, puree garlic cloves and onion. In a large saucepan over medium heat, combine oil, garlic onion puree, and tomato sauce. Cook for 15 to 20 minutes. And the third and final step. Pour sauce over cooled ribs and place them back on the grill to crisp up, or serve sauce on the side for dipping. And there's a little side column that's entitled Hot Seat. We grilled pitmaster Michael Simon, author of Playing with Fire, for his best barbecue advice. A few of Simon's must-haves: sturdy, long-handled tongs so you can easily flip your food without dropping it or burning your hand, a pair of elbow-length, heat-resistant grilling gloves, and a grill brush to prevent corrosion, bacteria, and charred bits that can gunk up your grates. Scrub them while they're still warm for easier cleanup. There are endless variables that can affect the meat cooking process: the intensity of the fire, the size and shape of the cut, the weather. Bring some precision to the party by trading in your timer for an instant thermometer, like the Javelin, $27, lavatools.co, to help prevent underdone or dried out results. Pork ribs, for example, should reach an internal temperature of 185 degrees, beef ribs about 200, and chicken around 165. Check out Simon's book for more temp guidelines. And as soon as your food comes out of the smoker or grill, you can wrap it tightly in plastic wrap, then aluminum foil, and put it in a well-insulated cooler. It'll stay warm and safe to eat for up to 4 hours, so you can move on to other preparations. Now we move to the second story of communal eating, and it's entitled Tabling the Issues. The North Carolina group serving community meals with a mission. In the aftermath of Hurricane Florence's blustering touchdown on North Carolina's coast in September 2018, local chef Scott Crawford, owner of Raleigh restaurant Crawford & Son, was stunned by the devastation, an estimated $24 billion in damage. At first, I was worried about how the storm would affect our business, but then that immediately changed when I saw the destruction so many chefs and farmers were facing, Crawford says. I realized I had to turn my focus toward the people who really needed it. He contacted Willa Kane, chair of the board for the Sunday Supper, a nonprofit enabling people to support their communities through food fundraisers. She helped him plan Come Together for the Coast, an effort that concluded with a community lunch last November. There, at white linen-covered tables spanning 2 blocks in downtown Raleigh, 1,000 ticket holders ate buffet style from a seasonal menu including braised collard greens and gingerbread sweet potato casserole. The initiative raised more than $450,000 for those hardest hit by Florence. Since its inception in the wake of Hurricane Matthew in 2016, the Sunday Supper has staged several similar functions in the region. It's a simple idea, but it's not a small one, says Kane. The group now offers a toolkit to help anyone host their own Sunday Supper meal. Learn more at thesundaysupper.org. Whether the crisis is a natural disaster or food insecurity, the goal is the same: to heal lives by breaking bread together. Our third story of a shared meal is entitled Act of Faiths. On the afternoon of 9/11, Rabbi Ira Azriel of the Temple Israel in Omaha couldn't bear to sit by quietly and do nothing. So he gathered a small party of synagogue members, and the group surrounded a local mosque, holding hands as a sign of unity. The symbolic power of that simple act inspired Azriel to reach out to other community leaders, and together they took a much larger step towards spiritual solidarity, the Tri-Faith Initiative. Founded in 2006, the nonprofit was created to help build a synagogue, a church, and a mosque in one sprawling commons, a project that was completed last year when Countryside Community Church opened its new space on the grounds it shares with Temple Israel and the American Muslim Institute. The goal? To bring the congregations closer so they could celebrate one another's differences. We want to honor that there are unique ways to have a relationship with something bigger than you, that we don't all have to do it the same, says Wendy Goldberg, the organization's interim executive director. And that vision beautifully comes to life at Tri-Faith's annual summer picnic. As volunteers grill kosher hot dogs and halal burgers, attendees gather around a smorgasbord of dishes provided by congregants and friends. The food we share with each other is astonishing, says Deb McAllister, a Countryside member who serves on the Tri-Faith board. Everything from potato salad to curries to challah, not to mention sticky sweet baklava, alongside pink frosted cupcakes and fluffy kugel casseroles, next to smoky baba ganoush dip from Tri-Faith's communications director, Arusa Jawad. The summer feast predates Tri-Faith's official founding and has grown from roughly 100 people at the inaugural gathering in 2002 to 400 at last year's picnic on the 38-acre campus. The menu rotates as the event progresses, encouraging guests to try different tastes and meet new friends throughout the day. There's a very intentional effort not to sit by with the people you came with, says Goldberg. Such bond building is encouraged beyond the picnic, too. Tri-Faith has a committee that places interested members and volunteers into multi-faith groups, in which everyone exchanges contact information and makes social plans. My group first met at a park just to snack and talk, says Temple Israel member Bonnie Lizarowitz. Now we're always texting, emailing, and attending each other's family events. And perhaps the best inspiration for coming together is courtesy of the picnic's youngest attendees, who flock to the face painting booth, waiting to be decked out in butterfly wings and tiger stripes. They want their faces painted to look like the kid next to them, even though they might not look alike at all, says Goldberg. They don't even know that there would be any reason why they wouldn't be friends. And with the story, we have the recipe for Arusa's baba ganoush. This recipe makes about 8 servings, and the total prep and cook time should be 1 hour and 20 minutes. The ingredients are 3 medium Italian eggplants, which is about 2 pounds total, 4 garlic cloves, minced, 2 tablespoons lemon juice from 1 lemon, 3 tablespoons tahini, 1/3 cup extra virgin olive oil plus more for drizzling, kosher salt, 1/4 cup pomegranate seeds, and finally, parsley or paprika for garnish, and those are optional. Step 1. Preheat oven broiler on high. On a foil-lined baking sheet, place whole, not punctured, eggplants. Broil, turning every 15 minutes until charred on all sides and deflated, about 1 hour. Remove and let cool. The second step, using a large spoon, scoop out all the flesh and juice from eggplants and discard the peels. Add to a food processor with garlic, lemon juice, tahini, oil, and salt. Pulse until smooth. Transfer to a serving bowl. Drizzle with oil and garnish with pomegranate seeds, plus parsley or paprika if desired. Serve with pita. Our fourth story of shared meals is entitled Band of Mothers. Every summer since 2010, pals Amber, Rebecca, Harmony, and Kristen have met up at South State Beach in Carlsbad, California for what they call their friendship picnic. When they promised to get together at least once a year, it was for deeper reasons than the joy of each other's company. Their families were in flux, and they needed support. At their first picnic, Amber and her husband had just brought their son, now 13, home from Ethiopia. A foster daughter, who's now 11, had just been placed with Kristen and her husband, and Harmony and Rebecca were both on waiting list for adoption referrals. Amber and Harmony were already friends when they met Buds, Rebecca, and Kristen, and the four women became close quickly, bonded by their shared experience with the adoption process. Nobody else knew what we were going through, and when I felt overwhelmed with our first foster daughter, one of the girls would be at my doorstep within the hour, says Kristen. We were even in the courtroom with one another when our adoptions were finalized. The mom's hangouts also became a source of stability for the children. 7 adopted and 9 biological, ages 3 to 16, helping them feel less alone in their non-traditional families. They've created this space of understanding and kinship that's so powerful, Kristen says. The kids spend their picnic time riding bikes along trails, teaching each other scooter tricks, splashing on boogie boards with their dads, and collecting seashells. And, of course, everybody eats all day long. The crew does a potluck setup, and Amber often brings a hearty chickpea-based stew called Shira Wat to give the 3 kids from Ethiopia a taste of their birth country. The children end the day with s'mores around a bonfire, and the moms continue sharing their challenges, answering questions about birth mothers and successes, helping sons and daughters stay connected to their culture over Greyhound cocktails, a refreshing blend of vodka, grapefruit juice, and rosemary sprigs. The fan favorite among all ages, Kristen's crisp on the outside, tender on the inside chocolate chip cookies. The brown butter gives them a caramel-like flavor, and the salted chocolate takes them over the top, says Rebecca. They're unreal. Divine desserts aside, the friends rely on their annual event for nourishment of a different kind. As our lives have gotten busier, the picnic has become our lifeline, says Amber. I really don't know how I would survive without these women. When someone truly understands your experience, it's this amazing connection that feels like home. And as a companion with the story, we have the recipe for Kristen's salted chocolate chip cookies with browned butter. This recipe makes 2 dozen cookies, and the total time is 30 minutes plus at least 3 hours for chilling the dough. And the ingredients are 2 sticks or 16 tablespoons of unsalted butter sliced into chunks, 1.5 cups packed dark brown sugar, 1/4 cup granulated sugar, 1 egg, 1 egg yolk, 1 vanilla bean, seeds scraped and pod discarded, 1 tablespoon plain Greek yogurt, 2.25 cups all-purpose flour, 1.5 teaspoons baking soda, 3/4 teaspoons sea salt flakes plus more for sprinkling, 3/4 cup semi-sweet chocolate chips, and 3/4 cup dark chocolate chips. Step 1. In a small saucepan over medium heat, melt butter, whisking continuously until you see tiny brown flakes on bottom of pan, about 5 minutes. Remove from heat immediately and transfer into a small bowl to prevent burning. Step 2. Once butter has cooled, pour into a large mixing bowl. Add sugars and beat on medium until combined. Add egg, yolk, vanilla, and yogurt and beat until combined. In a medium bowl, whisk together flour, baking soda, and salt. Add to wet ingredients and beat on low until just combined. Stir in chocolate chips. Chill dough for at least 3 hours or overnight. Step 5. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. On a parchment paper lined baking sheet, scoop 2 tablespoon balls of dough, evenly spaced. Bake until edges begin to brown, about 10 minutes. Step 6. Cool for 5 to 10 minutes on a baking sheet. Sprinkle with salt, then transfer to cooling racks. Repeat with remaining dough. Now our final story of shared meals is entitled happy campers. The Lyman family, whose ancestors migrated from Mexico to Texas in the late 18th century and helped found the Austin area, is more than 3,000 strong, and their annual reunions are fittingly grand scale. Every year, the relatives head to oak-studded Weberville Park, about a 30-minute drive from Austin, to set up camp for a gathering that proves everything's bigger in the Lone Star State. Their first celebration was a cookout in 1985, when the city government temporarily changed the name of Austin's Congress Avenue to Lyman Avenue. Now the event is a full weekend affair that requires closing the entire 135-acre park and coincides with the Red River Showdown, the annual football game between longtime rivals University of Texas and the University of Oklahoma. The colossal crew spends Friday setting up, catching up, and resting up for Saturday's festivities. We kick it off with a mass on Saturday morning, and then we have a huge agenda that starts with a big group picnic and ends with a dance at the main pavilion, says Gina Lyman, an Austin real estate agent who plans the event with her cousin Tracy and the family's reunion committee. The day's action also includes a pinata smashing, kickball, and the biggest showdown of all, a tug-of-war tournament. We start in an adults-only version where we go family against family, and we're pretty competitive, says Gina. We give out prizes, and it's the biggest hit of the day. Everyone rushes over to watch, adds Tracy. Each family branch donates meat, briskets, sausages, which are smoked to tender perfection ahead of the picnic. And everyone brings a shareable side or dessert to fill out the feast. The cool, creamy banana pudding, a Texas classic, is gone almost instantly, says Tracy. After battling it out and working up a sweat to top 40 hits, the Lymans have a hearty appetite by Sunday morning. Along with piles of bacon and fried potatoes, they serve Tex-Mex staples like breakfast tacos and migas, an egg scramble with slivers of pepper, corn tortilla squares, and pockets of melted cheddar. Everyone travels to each other's campsites for family time and, of course, for football watching. You can't see each other every day, but from the planning to the big event, the reunions keep us connected, says Gina. That's why our family works so hard on them. We can't let the tradition die. With nearly 1,000 people expected at their 34th reunion this October, it's safe to say it's alive and well. And along with this story, they have shared the recipe for the Lyman's Migas. This recipe makes 4 servings, and the total time should be about 30 minutes. And the ingredients are 2.5 tablespoons of vegetable oil, divided, 4 corn tortillas, cut into squares, 1/4 cup diced onion, 1/4 cup diced red or green bell pepper, 3 serrano or jalapeno peppers, diced, 1/4 cup diced tomato, 6 eggs, beaten, salt and ground black pepper, 1/2 cup shredded cheddar, plus more for topping, and, this is optional, cilantro chopped for garnish. Step 1. In a large skillet over medium-high heat, warm 2 tablespoons of the oil. Add tortilla squares and cook until crispy, 6 to 8 minutes. Set aside on a paper towel-lined plate. Step 2. To skillet, add the remaining 1/2 tablespoon oil, then add onion and bell pepper and sauté until soft, 6 to 8 minutes. Add tomato and cook another 5 minutes. Add eggs and salt and pepper to taste and scramble. Once eggs are set, add cheese and reserved tortilla squares and stir. Top with more cheese and cilantro if desired, and serve immediately. And as a companion to the stories of shared meals, Oprah Magazine interviewed a couple of chefs for their tips on how to make fantastic picnics. The first is Carla Hall, the author of Soul Food, and she's got tips to make your classic picnic foods fancier and healthier with these fresh ingredient upgrades. Meat isn't the only ingredient begging for barbecue sauce. Try brushing it on veggies like yellow plantains, sweet potatoes, and eggplant as they sear on the grill. The savory, sweet results will speak for themselves. Also, try replacing half the mayonnaise with olive oil on creamy picnic foods like deviled eggs, pasta salad, and coleslaw. You'll allow the other ingredients, like fresh herbs and vegetables, to shine, and picnickers will be less likely to feel overfull. And finally, super sugary iced tea can eventually zap your energy, but the plain, unsweetened stuff doesn't exactly taste like a celebration. The yummy medium? Fresh flavorings, and just enough sweetness to cut bitterness. Try this. In a small pot, combine 2 cups water, 2 cups sugar, 4 ounces ginger, peeled and coarsely grated, and 1/2 cup of mint leaves and tender stems. Bring to a boil, then reduce the heat and simmer 30 minutes. Remove from the heat and steep 1 to 4 hours. Strain into an airtight container, let cool and refrigerate. Add to iced tea to taste. This syrup can be stored in the fridge for up to 1 week. Our next set of picnic tips comes from Allie Rosen, and she's got ways to ensure that your next ocean outing goes swimmingly. She's the author of Bring It, Tried and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. And her advice begins with how to avoid soggy bread. She says use thicker slices, lightly toast them, and spread the condiments on the inside of both pieces. The oil from spreads like mayo and pesto creates a barrier to block some of the water from veggies and deli meats. She also says mushy greens are no picnic either. She advises to use hearty options like kale, romaine, or endive. Tender leaves like spinach or arugula will wilt faster in the heat. You can also stave off sogginess by keeping dressings separate until you're ready to eat. Next, she says, one windy gust can turn your exposed spread into a sandy mess. Try Bees Wraps Reusable Sustainable Wraps, which come in a variety of sizes and patterns, and you can find them beginning at $6 at beeswrap.com. That's spelled BEESWRAP.com. And finally, she advises that you drink responsibly. Staying hydrated is a given, but bring more water than you need for drinking so you can rinse your hands before and after meals in a pinch. And that concludes our feature article on picnics and shared community meals. Now we move to our next feature article, which is entitled The Way Out. The caption reads under the title, "Those who leave the ultra Orthodox Jewish community face a treacherous, often heartbreaking journey. One New York City organization is helping illuminate their path. Imagine you'd never seen the Wizard of Oz, or gotten sunburned at the beach, or twisted apart an Oreo and made tooth tracks on the filling, or pawed at your 10th grade boyfriend in the back of a Honda Civic. Imagine you'd never learned how fun it was to stay at the YMCA or taken scissors to your jeans to make short cutoffs or shaded in the bubbles on a SAT with a freshly sharpened No. 2 pencil. Imagine you'd never heard of the song Imagine or driven a car or celebrated Thanksgiving or learned that dinosaurs once existed. If you were Haredi, raised in ultra-Orthodox Judaism, this could be your experience. You grew up in an intensely insular, highly restrictive community where interacting with the outside world is rare. Despite being raised in America, you may have learned Yiddish as your first language. You were taught that God created the earth about 6,000 years ago. In your school books, anything involving evolution, sex, or reproduction was likely redacted with a black marker. If The pages hadn't been ripped out entirely. You may have been married to a virtual stranger at age 18 and expected to bear and rear as many as 12 children. And if it ever occurred to you to try to leave this confining world, you probably shoved that thought away. Going OTD, off the derech, or path in Hebrew, isn't like relocating from the city to the suburbs or flipping from Republican to Democrat. Leaving makes you a heretic, a pariah. It means you stand to be shunned by your family, ostracized by your friends, denied custody of your children, or all of the above. You may as well be boarding a one-way rocket to another planet. So terrifying and total is the leap. In the outside world, the isolation and disorientation can be all-consuming, even deadly. In recent years, at least two former Haredim, defeated by the process of trying to leave ultra-Orthodoxy behind, have taken their own lives. But the people that do leave have one thing working in their favor. An oasis that, since 2003, has given more than 1,500 of them practical support and vital guidance to make the perilous transition. Located in a downtown Manhattan skyscraper, the address is kept hidden to protect client safety. Footsteps office is infused with the buzzy, affirming cheeriness of a college dorm. The lounge is dominated by a pair of black leather sofas and a flat screen. Wire baskets of DVDs contain everything from Blazing Saddles to an educational film called Laugh and Learn About Childbirth. A cabinet holds a robust collection of board games, including Monopoly and Taboo, and the walls are covered with collages and paintings that favor symbols of confinement and freedom. A blindfolded woman, paper butterflies escaping a frame. A modest lending library offers classics of all types, The Hobbit, two copies of The Scarlet Letter, a near-complete set of Sue Grafton's alphabet detective novels, though someone needs to solve the mystery of where C is for corpse disappeared to. A tray bears a stack of stickers with a defiant phrase, "On my own derech," in chunky capital letters. A canister of condoms is perched near pamphlets explaining how to use them. There's a well-lit nook with desktop computers that footsteps clients, known as members, are welcome to use 3 nights a week. For those who still live in ultra-Orthodox homes, many of which don't have computers, it may be one of the few places they can access the internet or type up a resume. There's also a tiny room where social workers meet with newbies. A dish of plastic toys sits on the table between them, for anxious hands that need to fiddle. To become a part of this brave new world, members pay a one-time $25 fee, then sign an agreement stating they won't share information about any other members or out them for being associated with the organization. Footsteps founder Malky Schwartz was born into an ultra-Orthodox Lubavitch community in Brooklyn. The eldest of nine, she was taught to be a sweet girl and follow the rules. Wear modest clothes that covered her from clavicle to knee, with tights underneath. Say different prayers depending on whether she was eating fruit or noodles. Kiss the mezuzah on the doorframe every time she entered or left the house. But at 17, Schwartz began to feel mounting anxiety about her future in the community. During the holiday Simchat Torah, she felt like she was watching the celebrations through a dense pane of glass. "I realized how separate I felt from everyone else," she says. "I was like, I don't feel joy about living according to the Torah. I don't feel a connection, and I can't force one." Then, like many Lubavitch girls, she went to Israel for a year to study at seminary. But instead of cementing her faith, the experience revealed its cracks. By the time she turned 19, the mental shift was nearly complete. "I knew I'd be expected to start having kids very quickly once I married," she says, "and I took the responsibility of bringing children into that world very seriously. I thought, Do I know enough about what else is out there to say that this is the road I want to go down? The answer, she realized, was no. A few months after returning from Israel, Schwartz, amid great internal torture and torment, moved in with her non-Orthodox grandmother and enrolled in Hunter College in Manhattan. I had no clue what was going to become of me, she says, beyond the potential loss of my relationships with everyone I loved, everyone who shaped who I was. Wanting to sort out her turbulent feelings, Schwartz tapped into a whisper network to find other people like her. She arranged covert meetups at coffee shops, even once on a subway platform. There was so much shame, she says. But after talking with a few people, I thought, why are we making this so difficult for ourselves? She reserved a room at Hunter and asked a social worker to lead a discussion group for any former Orthodox people who were interested. About 25 came the first month, most in their 20s and 30s, and predominantly men. The majority had already left the community, but a few still living as haredim came back in high-crowned black hats or the requisite wigs. They spoke of why they left, or wanted to, the hypocrisy they felt they'd witnessed, the beliefs that didn't resonate with them, the education they hadn't been able to pursue. With that meeting, Footsteps was born. I formed what I needed, says Schwartz, a community of other people who understood. Footsteps now offers drop-in support groups centered around PTSD and substance abuse, as well as healthy relationships training that covers topics like sexual assault and harassment. But mental health resources are just the beginning of what the newly secular might need. Ultra-Orthodox schools may not conform to state educational standards, meaning students could be denied a high school diploma, so Footsteps helps members prepare for their GED. It also offers college counseling and scholarships, with more than 1.5 million granted so far. The group is funded by secular and Jewish foundations and private donors. According to Footsteps, Amy Schumer gave $10,000 last year. Members can also reach out to Footsteps for help landing an internship or acing a job interview. If a member finds herself desperately needing money for groceries or utility bills, she can ask Footsteps for emergency funding. And there's a Go For It grant, which offers up to $500 for members interested in driving lessons, art classes, language courses, or other forms of self-improvement, says Jennifer Friedland, a Footsteps spokesperson. We do everything from nuts and bolts stuff like helping people file their taxes to helping them find a life that feels full. Most of those who leave ultra-Orthodoxy struggle early on, especially financially. Finding a well-paying job without so much as the GED is extremely tricky. Plus, some OTDers have heavy accents or aren't accustomed to shaking hands with the opposite sex, which can make interviewing awkward. Renting an apartment without steady employment is close to impossible. For members who find themselves homeless or just hungry, the organization keeps its kitchen stocked with frozen burritos, coffee, yogurt, Sun Chips. And established members have temporarily opened their homes to new ones who need a place to stay while transitioning. About 35% of Footsteps members have kids, and the vast majority are divorced. The organization's speedily growing Family Justice Program helps them fight for custody or visitation. Footsteps trains lawyers from prestigious New York City firms to take on members' cases. It also offers funds for parents who need to buy transcripts of their court cases or hire experts. Custody battles are often grueling. Ultra-Orthodox sects can wield serious financial muscle against apostates, and it's common that the spouses who stay behind don't pay a dime in legal fees. The community covers them entirely. Footsteps is infamous among the hundreds of thousands of haredim in the U.S., regarded by some as a dangerous influence, by others as an insidious evil. When someone leaves the community, the ultra-Orthodox, sometimes say the person joined footsteps. The organization has been accused of actively tempting people away from their comfortable lives. In fact, the group does no advertising in the community and doesn't require members to renounce religion in order to use its services or participate in get-togethers. "We don't care if people just come in for a scholarship," says Friedland. "We don't care if they go back to Hasidism afterwards. We don't have an agenda. And contrary to the rumors, we don't force men to cut off their curly side locks, nor do we feed anyone bacon as part of an initiation rite," she says with a laugh. "We just want people to have choices." For the sake of time, I'm going to cut this article short here, and we will pick it up next week with our third and final installment of the July 2019 Oprah Magazine. But before we go, we are going to take a look at the question of the month. Going back to our article about communal eating and picnics, our question of the month is, what's your go-to cookout dish? Connie Pelton of Wisconsin says, "No summer gathering is complete without my scotcheroo bars. The recipe involves warming sugar and corn syrup in a pot over low heat with peanut butter. Then you add Rice Krispies. Transfer the mixture to a pan and melt butterscotch and chocolate chips to spread over the top. Let it cool, and once it's firm, cut into pieces to share. And if the sun melts the treats and makes a mess, licking your fingers clean is part of the deliciousness." Debbie Eisenhower of Kansas says, "Strawberry pretzel salad. It's easy enough for an appetizer and yummy enough for a dessert. It has a savory pretzel crust covered with a whipped cream layer and a sweet jello topping with fresh strawberries. For the 4th of July, I decorate it with blueberries and white icing to create a flag." Now we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, reading for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.